The Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine in the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. But don't hurry, because this offer probably loses us money.
Hello and welcome to Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week I'm joined by the biographer Mark Bostridge, whose new book is In Pursuit of Love, The Search for Victor Hugo's Daughter. Now, the story of Adele Hugo is a very poignant and strange and hard to research one. And Mark, I wanted to ask, what was the sort of inciting incident? Because this is a sort of story of obsession in some ways. It's almost as much a book about you as it is about Adele. And I'm wondering how you first met your subject.
Well, actually, it goes back 40 years when I was a student, and I went to see François Truffaut's film about Adele Hugo, L'Histoire d'Adèle Ash, starring Isabella Gianni. And I was fascinated by the story then, partly because I was fascinated by the Brontes at the time, and the story has a very kind of Brontean kind of feel to it. And in fact, Truffaut described it as his Bronte film. And so that sort of planted the seed of it. Also, I happened to go to that showing. The film had been made in 1975. I didn't see it till about 1982. But I went with the first person I ever thought of myself as being in love with. And it was a tortured love affair, because he didn't ever tell me he loved me. And it was quite obvious to him that I was in love with him. So it had a great sort of impact on me. And then some 17 years later, I went to Viquier for the first time. I think I went there probably in the wake of Graham Robb's biography of Victor Hugo, which is a superb book, which kind of reignited my interest in it. Although Graham had tried to find out more about Adele and about Albert Pinson, the man she was so disastrously in love with, and hadn't managed to do so. But Viquier is where my book starts, because that is where, in a sense, the tragedy of Adele Hugo's life begins, because her elder sister, Leopoldine, is drowned on the Seine there in 1843.
And what was the effect on the family dynamic of the death of Leopoldine?
Well, the effect was that her father immediately immortalised Leopoldine, the older daughter, and basically ignored the younger one, Adele, in some way. The circumstances in which Victor Hugo discovered about his daughter's death are horrifying, because he was travelling with his mistress, Juliette Drouet, and he went into a bar, picked up a newspaper, and there was this terrible report of his daughter's death. I mean, absolutely horrifying way to find out about something like that. And the result was that Victor Hugo wrote eventually some of his greatest poetry, inspired by the process of mourning, inspired by the memory of Leopoldine, and also dealing with the idea of coming to life again after this terrible family tragedy had happened. But it did obviously have a great impact, not only on Adele, but on her mother and on her two brothers. And this was intensified even further when Victor Hugo left France in opposition, because he was in opposition to Napoleon III. He left France and was exiled himself to the Channel Islands. And in the house he reconstructed in Guernsey — he lived first on Jersey and then he moved to Guernsey — the whole family lived surrounded by relics of Leopoldine. And one of those was he built a cupboard in Hauteville House in Guernsey and put in it the dress that Leopoldine had been wearing when she drowned.
And as you say, it started out with a visit to the place where Leopoldine drowned. Where was it that Adele snagged on you in that circumstance?
So I went to the Maison Vacquerie on my first visit to Viquier, and I walked into the museum and there was a facsimile of a page from Adele's journal on the wall. And I asked the custodian about it, and she immediately said to me, "This is Leopoldine's museum, not Adele's," which kind of sort of solidified the idea that Adele was always going to be in the shadows, whereas Leopoldine was the major figure, the major inspiration of Victor Hugo's creative life. And therefore, I I wanted to rescue Adele from the shadows, but I also knew that there was a great mystery at the heart of her story, because she had become obsessed with an English soldier, had followed him first to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and then to Barbados. But nobody had ever really found out anything about the English soldier and his motivation in all this. And so there was a mystery there that I was intrigued by. And gradually over the years, I began to collect material about this. And then eventually I made various discoveries about him.
And did you think right at the beginning, this is going to be a book? Or was it simply a matter of pursuing a personal fascination?
I always thought it was going to be a book. Well, I hoped it would be a book, but I couldn't see how to do it, because one of the great problems with the story is that if you told Adele's story straight, it's so tragic and so unrelieved by any colour or humour that I couldn't see it would attract many readers. There are biographies of Adele in French, and in fact there's one in English that was published in Canada some 30 years ago, but they're all missing vital pieces of the jigsaw, so they don't really make much sense. So in 1999, when I returned from VQA, at the time I was in an intense biographical relationship with Florence Nightingale, which I was desperately trying to get out of, because that was an impossible book to write, and I thought, I can't do this. And the only problem was that I would have had to have given the considerable advance back. And so I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll write a quick novel about Adele and therefore not have to do the bigger project. I did start to write it, but I didn't manage to finish it. But it did strike me even then that you had to have two stories going on simultaneously. So in the novel version, there was a biographer researching Adele's story, and then you had Adele herself in the foreground.
We should say for the readers that Mark's biography of Florence Nightingale was a possible project and was completed and was, by all accounts, a huge success. So, you know, available to buy still.
It took 10 years of my life.
But the story that you ended up writing isn't a novel, but it is one in which the biographer's pursuit is front and centre. I mean, what's really startling and moving and often sort of slightly dismaying about the book is the way in which your relationship with the subject starts to kind of feed back and tell you things about yourself.
Yes, I realised that in order to write a more innovative kind of biography, I needed to show the ways in which aspects of Adele's story obsessed, appealed to me. Why was I so interested in this story? What was it that I liked so much? I mean, the quest aspect of the book obviously has been done before, but the influence there has always been A.J.A. Simmons' book, The Quest for Corvo. Simmons tried to find out about the author, Baron Corvo, as he was known, of the famous Hadrian novel, a book that was published in 1934, which sort of shook up biography at the time. It probably isn't as well known as it should be now, but I think it's still in print. And obviously you have Richard Holmes's footsteps much later on. So the quest element has always been there in biographical writing. But what hasn't, I think, is an examination of the biographer, him or herself, to show why they're attracted to a subject and what they actually bring to it themselves. Because you are obviously trying to express yourself, even though you're right, you are obviously trying to express things about yourself, even though you're writing about someone else.
Can you give us a sketch to start with of what Adele was like, how her, you know, what her situation was? You talked about this disastrous issue with Leopoldine. I mean, how old was Adele when that happened? And what did the Hugo family's exile into the Channel Islands, you know, what effect did that have? How did that change her world?
She was 13 when her sister died, and she was about 22 when the family left Paris and moved to Jersey at first. And then 5 years later, they were chucked out of Jersey because of one of the French refugees' attack on Queen Victoria. The islanders told Victor Hugo to go, and so he moved to Guernsey. The period that Adele spent on the Channel Islands was in a sense a form of imprisonment, because she couldn't leave the island without being chaperoned by her mother, Her brothers, she had two elder brothers, Charles and François Victor, even they had problems getting away from their father's surveillance. And of course, Victor Hugo grew to love the Channel Islands more and more because he completed so much work there. He could get much more writing done in Jersey and Guernsey than he could in Paris. And he had one of the great successes of his poetic life when he moved to Guernsey, Les Contemplations, which was a bestseller, which enabled him to reconstruct this extraordinary house in Guernsey. And then, of course, at the height of Adele's own story, when she is about to make her flight from the family home, he's desperately trying to finish Les Miserables. So it was a very hard life for her, because what I hadn't realised when I started writing this book was in fact that French women of the period were much less liberated than English women. I mean, they really couldn't marry anyone. I mean, obviously, this is middle-class women, really couldn't marry anyone who wasn't chosen by their parents. And also, they couldn't leave the house, their family home, without being chaperoned by a female member of the family. And so that was very hard on Adele. And she spent years, she was interested in music. She composed music, which her father didn't initially give her much encouragement with. She also completed this extraordinary diary or journal, which has been published in four volumes. The problem with the journal for the biographer is it really isn't basically about Adele. It's about Victor Hugo, because Victor Hugo encouraged Adele to write a record of his table talk. And so occasionally in code, you get snatches of what's going on in Adele's life, her obsessions, her feelings of love for this English soldier. But ultimately, it's really just the pearls of wisdom that drop from Victor Hugo's lips.
He does seem to have exerted a kind of gravitational field of ego, doesn't he? I mean, he's a real sacred monster, Pierre. I found myself, I wouldn't say exactly, not warming to Hugo particularly in the course of your book. I don't know whether that's an intended effect.
I think so. I'm sure other people think of his genius as perhaps being more important than his status as paterfamilias. But if you go to Hauteville House, which is a museum in Guernsey, which, as I say, he reconstructed in his image, every piece of furniture, every piece of china that's on display is an embodiment of his ego. And for his family to live in a house like that, I often, you know, what is it like to live surrounded by your father's ego every hour of the day? I mean, it would just drive you mad.
Well, you talk a little bit about the difficulty of your own father as well. That's one of the points at which this story seems to touch yours. Is that fair to say?
Yes. I talk about my father partly because, like Victor Hugo, my father had an eye for the ladies and had a record of marital infidelity that was pretty extraordinary, but also because I wanted to show parallels, very loose parallels, but parallels nevertheless in my life with Adele. So when I was 11, I was knocked over by a car in Ostend. Unfortunately, my father that weekend had been revealed to be having yet another affair with a woman. And my mother had been phoned by this woman's husband who said, I'm going to name your father in my divorce petition. And so my father had to fly out to Ostend and bring me home. And this was a great shock to him. I think he felt a great deal of guilt about this because basically I had almost been killed while he was sort of having a relationship with someone who wasn't my mother. And so there's a very loose parallel there, obviously, with Victor Hugo's discovery of his daughter's death while he was travelling with his mistress, which also produced an enormous amount of guilt and made it unable for him to write poetry for the next few years. So throughout the book, I have made, I hope, quite loose parallels, and I haven't tried to push them down the reader's throat. I mean, undoubtedly, one of the things that first attracted me to the story was the idea of unrequited love, because Adele is destroyed by her love for this English soldier, Albert Pinson, who probably definitely wanted to marry her, but who rejected her ultimately, leaving her to take flight in July 1863 and follow him to Nova Scotia. And I feel in the early part of my life was very much bedeviled by unrequited love. I was always falling in love with inappropriate people who didn't have the same feelings for me. I've done a number of events, public events, and at those events I ask people to put up their hands if they have suffered unrequited love in their lives, and hardly anybody ever does so. I mean, it's something they obviously don't want to admit to. So I'm pretty open about that, which I didn't find easy to be open about it, but it was necessary for the book.
Well, this business, this kind of dramatic, single dramatic pivot of the book is when Adele is a leaves. I mean, she's a mouse. She's sitting there. She's transcribing her father's table talk dutifully. She's entirely at the service of this, you know, towering genius. She's kind of locked in this island. And then, extraordinarily, she takes off, you know, without telling anyone, and is on the other side of the world. Now, did you ever feel you got to the bottom of how to read that? Because it seems there are so many different factors going in here. You know, was it love for Pinson himself, sort of straightforward love, or a kind of idea of love she was pursuing, a kind of pathology? Or was it about, in some way, just asserting any sort of agency to get out from under her father?
Yeah, I think all those things are very true. I think one of the most important things to remember is that she was 33 at the time of her flight in 1863, when she decided to pursue Pinson to Nova Scotia and make him marry her, because he had promised to marry her. I mean, one of the discoveries I made by contacting his descendants was that there was a marriage license, and that he had at some point intended or said he was going to marry her. And at 33, this was really her last chance. So a lot of people would say, well, she was mad and she flung herself at him. But actually, there was something very rational in what she did. She wanted to get him to marry her because she had rejected every other suitor that her parents had put forward. The only alternative was to remain locked up with her father for the rest of her life. In another way, I think when she leaves Guernsey, she thinks of herself as a pioneer because she has feminist ideas. Her journal occasionally refers to these. She was obviously influenced by the works of Georges Sand, for instance. And she saw herself as a pioneer. She said it would be quite something for a young woman who isn't even allowed to go out down the street and buy a ream of paper to follow her lover from the old world to the new world. This I shall do. That's what she writes, and that's exactly what she does. Of course, when she gets to Halifax, Nova Scotia, where Pinson is stationed with his regiment, the sort of illusions begin to grow. So she writes home to her parents that she's married and that she will henceforth be known as Madame Pinson. And of course, this is complete nonsense because Pinson has continued to reject her and will in fact never marry her. He marries somebody else. So there's a mixture of very rational purpose, and also you see the beginnings of the disintegration, which will eventually lead to her complete loss of sanity. I was very amused actually yesterday to receive a card from Bruce Robinson, the great director of Withnail and I,
who amazingly has a part in this story.
He has a part in this story because he played Albert Pinson in the Truffaut film. But as he told me, he was hopelessly, as he put it, in love with Isabella Gianni, who must have been only 19 or 20 at the time. And so in his case, the story was completely reversed. His Pinson was hopelessly in love with Adele, as portrayed by Isabella Gianni. So I thought,
well, everyone was in love with Isabella Gianni, weren't they? Truffaut was as well.
Yes, exactly. I wrote back to him and I said, this must have been a very intense film set, with the director and the co-star being in love with the actress.
That's remarkable, that detail. I was, oh, God, it's Bruce Robinson. Fancy that. Now, Pinson, though, I mean, he didn't look much like Bruce Robinson. He, at least at the start of your research, was this extraordinary mystery, wasn't he? I mean, was he a mustachioed cad? Was he a, you know, what was it? How did you find out about him? What was available to find out?
Well, I fell back on fiction to try and understand the kind of person he might have been, which of course is not a good way to approach biography. So there are two very obvious cads in 19th century fiction. There's Sergeant Troy in Far From the Madding Crowd, who likes betting on the horses, as Pynson was said to have done. And even more compellingly to me, there's Maurice Townsend in Henry James's Washington Square, who pursues the heroine in order really to get her money. Henry James's great feat of genius is to make the heroine's father even more, even crueler than the scoundrel suitor. But obviously that wasn't going to take me very far. I knew that Albert Pynson was introduced to Adele in about 1854, shortly after she got to Jersey. She claimed that he had been walking along the beach, looked up and saw her, and immediately fell in love with her for life, which obviously wasn't the case. But Pynson in 1854 had been introduced into the Hugo household at Marine Terrace in Jersey. He took part in the seances that went on there because Victor Hugo was very interested in the spiritualist life and interested in raising spirits, including, of course, Leopoldine's spirit. And so one of Pynson's first introductions to the Hugo household was to arrive at Marine Terrace, suddenly be shrouded into darkness, sit at a table, because they were into table tapping, where tables moved and you spelt out words. And Adele writes in her journal, "I felt his knee pressing against mine." But again, he then disappears because he joins the army. And only slowly did I begin to realise that in the latter part of her confinement on the Channel Islands, she was obviously plotting with her mother, who also wanted to get away from Victor Hugo and go back to Paris. She was plotting with her mother to leave the island, often for quite long periods at a time, in order to meet up with Albert Pynson in London, for instance, or on the Isle of Wight. She did this in the late 1850s, but the decisive piece of evidence, which has happened once before in my biographical career, that I rang up somebody and found out they had extraordinary evidence relating to the story I was trying to tell, which always makes me think that, you know, it's not just about libraries and archives. You really have to get out on the ground and go on your own quest. Was that I finally managed to track down Pynson's descendants, who are called the Pynson Roxburghs. And I went to see them, and they had a wedding license for 1861, which showed that Pynson had intended to marry her.
Yes, you did. It sounds like, in the way you describe it, they were kind of hesitant to show this to you. It was almost sort of at the end of this long conversation, they go, "Can we trust you?"
Exactly. I mean, imagine somebody turning up at your house and starting talking about your ancestor. Also, there's a worry for the biographer that things are going to turn out so badly that you're going to have to show their ancestor in a very, very bad light. So I said to them, "Do you mind whatever I find out?" And they said, no. "You know, we may be blood relations, but blood in this case isn't necessarily thicker than water." But very kindly, they first showed me a photograph they discovered of Pynson, because nobody had a clue as to what he looked like. And as you said, and as Bruce Robinson said, obviously he didn't look anything like him, because Pynson, you know, had one of those post-Crimean War beards. You know, they disappeared, men and soldiers especially disappeared under hair. And they also then said, "Well, we have this document." And the document, which is the marriage license for December 1861, you fit it into the jigsaw of what was going on in Adele's life and in the Hugo household's life back in Guernsey. Because Adele writes to her father and says, you sort of threatens him. First of all, she says, "You know, you are a genius, you will live forever, but you must allow me to have my own life." Then she goes on to say, "But if you don't allow me to marry this man, who knows what disaster may fall both on your reputation and on mine." So there's a kind of threat in it. And Hugo had been opposed to Leopoldine's marriage to Charles Vacquerie. And so Adele very cleverly reminds him at the end of her letter that he had been opposed to his elder daughter's marriage, and that had worked out very well during the short period in which the couple were married before they both drowned, that therefore she offers him Albert Pynson in memory of her dead sister, Leopoldine. And so Hugo, who is completely submerged, as he puts it, with the writing and rewriting of Les Misérables, which we must remember was I think had received the highest advance for any novel up to that point in the history of publishing.
He puts her into it, doesn't he? I mean, you've got an extraordinary quote in which you get a kind of glimpse of Pynson and her.
Yes. Well, he after Pynson visits them on Christmas Day 1861, when Hugo is revising Les Misérables, he goes away without asking he goes away without asking Victor Hugo formally for Adèle's hand in marriage, which is very surprising. And it's very difficult to account for that. And basically, in the next weeks, Hugo puts a little portrait of him as a vain, small-waisted, worthless little English trooper into the novel. And so Albert Pynson, at that point in 1861, goes off to Nova Scotia because there are tensions between Canada and America over the Trent Affair, and there's a fear that there will be war. So all these English troops are suddenly mobilised.
Which, so briefly, so I was going to say, Hugo was quite responsive, wasn't he, to Adèle's threats, in as much as the fear of scandal seems to have, or the fear of, you know, damaged his reputation, seems to have really actuated a lot of his behaviour during this, doesn't he? One of the piercing things is that, you know, he doesn't write to her. Not once, over decades.
I think that is one of the most shocking things of all. Of course, in the Truffaut film, you hear Victor Hugo's voice on the soundtrack sort of writing to his daughter. Nothing could have been more untrue, because for the 8 years that Adèle was in her own exile in Nova Scotia and in Barbados, Hugo wrote not one word to her. He communicated to her through her younger brother, Francois Victor, to whom she'd always been very close. And I wonder whether, and one of the mysteries of the story is, as you say, she may have been pursuing her own ideal of love. She may really have been in love with Pynson all that time, or else she also may have been trying to punish her father by pursuing a man who was everything her father wasn't. He may well have been, in some senses, a gambler, sort of a worthless man. He was a royalist, as she said, when, of course, the Hugo family were all Republican. So politically, socially, he wasn't very well born. He wasn't what her father wanted for his daughter.
And when she did go to Nova Scotia, I mean, she had this kind of very etiolated life, didn't she? I mean, she was just sort of, as far as I can tell, and you do the Holmes thing and follow in her footsteps, she's essentially just traipsing the streets of Nova Scotia, kind of stalking Pynson. I mean, you know, in 1980s terms, you might call her a bit of a bunny boiler.
Yes, she was a bunny boiler. She didn't go as far as to boil his bunnies, but I did, sorry, that's a rather unfortunate phrase.
Well, it's a slightly misogynistic trope anyway, but it is the one that springs to mind.
It is the one that springs to mind. But I have often wondered whether when she pursued him to the doors of the barracks and stood outside for hours waiting for him to come out, and whether he looked at her with a look of fear. I mean, was he frightened of her? Because undoubtedly one of the reasons he had initially been persuaded to take out that marriage license was that she had threatened to kill herself. But I think when I went to Nova Scotia and saw the Citadel, which is the great sort of Canadian barracks in the middle of the city, I then got a little map and plotted out all the properties. I think she lived in about 7 properties during her years in Nova Scotia, and they're all surrounding the Citadel, so she was always within easy reach of him. And as I said, stood outside the barracks in all weathers waiting for him to come out. I mean, today, of course, she would have probably not been locked up, but she would have been given therapy, which probably wouldn't have been very effective, because I don't think therapy to deal with stalkers is ever very effective.
Can I pick you up also on something we mentioned earlier, but it slightly fascinated me, and your approach to it fascinated me. You talk about this, you know, it was the height of the sort of spiritualism craze, table tapping, they were doing all these seances. And you seem in the way you approach it to be quite kind of open-minded about the possibility that there might be something supernatural there, because your own experience, kind of, you drop in relatively casually. is that you, for much of your 20s, saw ghosts.
Yes, my brother, who's a singer, was once in a Royal Opera House production of The Turn of the Screw. And, you know, of course, Henry James's famous ghost story made into an opera by Benjamin Britten. And my brother gave an interview to the Evening Standard and it had a headline saying, "I have never seen any ghosts, but my brother has." And my father was absolutely appalled. He rang me up and said, "The world will think you're mad." I mean, insofar as the world were reading the Evening Standard then, but he thought that was a terrible sort of slur on my character.
Were you upset by it?
No, not at all, because I thought I did see ghosts, because I experienced what I now know to be called hypnopompic hallucinations, so that I would wake in the night and see people who were incredibly real to me. They didn't disappear through doors. They just disappeared into the thin air. But while they were standing in front of me, they were incredibly real. So I saw two Victorian women, I always remember. I lived in a house, a 19th century house, and there were always, practically every night at one point for a couple of months, these two sisters. I knew they were sisters, and they were always flitting through my room, and they never spoke, but they looked at me very intensively. And then there were various other sort of instances of this. And I knew a Cambridge scientist called Graham Mitchison, and he was investigating dreams with his partner, the illustrious Francis Crick, one of the discoverers of DNA. And Graham wanted to hook me up to various electrical bits of machinery to monitor my sleep and see what these apparent ghost appearances really were. I didn't in the end let him do that. But yes, one of the interests of the story is that the Hugo family for a time were all convinced that the conversations they had through the tables with the dead, and it wasn't only Leopoldine, it was Jesus Christ, Racine, Mohammed, all conveniently speaking in French.
Yes, and all very keen on the works of Victor
all,
Hugo.
Exactly, all praising Victor Hugo for his, not only for his writing, but also for his idea of a visionary new religion. They were all convinced that they were speaking to the dead. And in fact, Adele, after the main seances were over, used to take the little table up to her room and speak to Leopoldine, asking her advice about her relationship with Albert Pinson and whatever should she do.
Now, one of the mysteries about this relationship with Albert Pinson is that, as you describe towards the end of the book, you know, letters exist, not many of them, but some of them, that were from Pinson to Adele. You know, when you would think he would long since, you know, he's married, he's moved, he's gone back to the old world, and he's writing to her in Barbados. He's in, I guess, in England, isn't he, at this stage? And he's writing to her in a kind of friendly, affectionate, you know, I would like to see you sort of way. How do you account for that?
I know that Pinson's family were very pleased that the resolution of the story put him in a better light. And I was indeed very pleased that these letters turned up, because I went all the way to Barbados. And Barbados Archives, the staff there are very pleasant and very helpful, but they have a very laid-back approach to archival research. And the archives didn't actually give me very much. And then I came back to England, and Pinson's great-grandson's wife, who was one of the main spurs to my work in this area, because she was so interested in the subject, said to me, do you know that there are some letters from Pinson in the British Library? Which was quite extraordinary. And I thought, I'd been all the way to Barbados, but actually some decisive evidence is actually on my doorstep. And what happened was that at the end of the 19th century, the British Library, or the British Museum as it was then, quite often bought up large collections of manuscripts just for the autographs in them. And someone in the Bank of Barbados had found these manuscripts, some of which had Victor Hugo's signature, some of which were from his wife, and some were from Pinson to Adele and to Adele's brother. These manuscripts, these collections of autographs have been given to the British Museum and then been transferred to the British Library eventually. And so I got photographs of these letters, of Pynson's letters to Adele and to her brother, because he initially makes contact with Francois Victor, her brother, and says, tell your sister that I'm fed up with her pursuing me for the last however many years, and offers to fight a duel with him. But then the tone of the letter suddenly change, and Pynson, there are a couple of letters from Pynson to Adele in which he's very worried about her because she's still in Barbados. He's come back to England where he marries someone, a rich woman. But he's saying to her, you must come back to Europe. You must return. And I really would encourage you to do so. And when you get back to Europe, I look forward to seeing you and telling you about all the changes in my life, which was rather a strange thing to tell her because the changes in his life encompass not only marriage, but also the birth of his only son. This seems very strange. And the only thing I could really understand about it was that he'd come to some agreement with Francois Victor, Adele's brother, that he would try to encourage Adele to come back to France, because by that time, Victor Hugo had himself returned to Paris, and that Pynson himself stood to lose quite a lot as well, because he had married into a wealthy family, the Roxburgh family. How much they knew about his Hugolian past, I don't know. But obviously the scandal on both sides was still very alive. The Hugos didn't want to present Adele as having gone all the way to Nova Scotia and then returned unmarried. And obviously the Roxburgh family didn't want to know that Pynson had been in some senses in breach of contract with Adele.
And what was it? Because it wasn't, unfortunately, Pynson's blandishments that brought her back. What finally got Adele on a boat?
This very kind Caribbean woman, possibly an ex-slave or possibly from the family of former slaves, came across her wandering in the streets of Barbados in that great heat, wearing clothes totally unsuited to the climate, furs and velvets, this strange kind of Miss Havisham-like figure wandering the streets of Barbados, and took pity on her and housed her, and by some strange roundabout route got a letter to Victor Hugo saying, I have your daughter in my care and I want to return her to you. And eventually she borrowed money from a friend in Martinique, got the fare to bring Adele back on a boat to Paris. This was 1872. Adele recognised her father. She didn't recognise her brother, Francois Victor. And almost immediately, she was put into an institution on the outskirts of Paris. Then in 1885, so 13 years later, when Victor Hugo himself dies, there's a burst of astonishment when newspapers writing Victor Hugo's obituary find out that he does indeed have a daughter still living and that she's in a mental institution. Not only that, but under the terms of Victor Hugo's will, she inherits all his copyrights. So she's an incredibly rich woman. And after Victor Hugo's death, she moves to a luxury nursing home in Suresnes, where she lives until 1915.
Yes, it's a fantastically long life. Now, a figure in the book is your partner or boyfriend, R. Can I say, did he feel a little bit like Princess Di, you know, there's three of us in this marriage? He was sort of feeling rivalrous towards Adele for him.
I don't think he felt rivalrous, but he certainly got fed up with being taken to Viquier, which we did on various... We went there so many times in the course of 10 years, I think. And ultimately, what is very sad for me in the story is that he himself had problems with his mental health and had a breakdown and ended up in a terrible hospital at St. Pancras before he was moved, fortunately, to a private hospital. And at that time, it seemed to me as if my pursuit of Adele was turning into the story's pursuit of me, because it was beginning to echo my own life in ways that weren't very happy or pleasant.
Did you feel, do you feel that by finishing the book, you've, you know, with your indulgence, set her free?
I've set her free. I've also set myself free. I mean, I do think sometimes writing books can be cathartic, and you get rid a lot of things that you've lived with for years. So not only the unhappiness regarding the health of somebody close to you, but also all the time I wasted on mooning after people who didn't have the same kind of feelings for me. I feel all that is over. But actually, with unrequited love, if you're susceptible to unrequited love, you always have to be on the lookout for its possible impact on you in the future. You can never be sure that you're entirely free of that predisposition.
Mark Bostridge, thank you very much. In Pursuit of Love is out now.
Thank you.